Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada. Here's Jane Williams.
Motherhood is eternally fulfilling and rewarding. It's always the best and most important thing you do. And if you don't love every second of it, then there's something really wrong with you. This is the mommy myth. According to Susan Douglas and Meredith Michaels, mothers would be much better off without it. In fact, they are downright oppressed by it. Susan Douglas and Meredith Michaels wrote The Mommy Myth, published earlier this year by Free Press. And Susan Douglas joins me this morning from Michigan. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm pretty good, thanks. Now, you coin a term right at the beginning of the book called the new momism. What do you mean by that?
Well, the new momism is a highly romanticized and utterly idealized myth of the perfect mother in which the standards for success are utterly impossible to achieve.
So what are the standards for success?
Well, you know, where to begin? When the baby is just a little spark in our eye and growing in our womb, we have to pipe Mozart in there so that the baby comes out perfectly tuned. Then, when the baby is 6 months, we're supposed to start drilling him or her with flashcards. By the time the baby's a year and a half, we have to have him or her up, you know, sitting in front of a computer screen, learning quadratic equations. We have to drive them 10 hours round trip to a soccer match by the time they're 5 years old, teach them to read the Iliad by the time they're seven, and so on and so forth. I mean, it's just, you know, the sort of input that mothers are supposed to have, which the sociologist Sharon Hayes has referred to as intensive mothering, has just meant that our to-do list has absolutely gone through the roof.
Now, you say that it's a direct descendant of the feminine mystique described by Betty Friedan in the 1960s. How so?
Well, you know, you wouldn't think it is because, you know, we think of the feminine mystique as very old-fashioned. You know, women were supposed to be ecstatic about housework. Every woman was supposed to stay home with her children and be a mother her entire life. And women really were supposed to be subservient to men, and so we don't think that anymore. And so, you know, in some ways, the new attitudes around motherhood seem on the surface to be much more progressive because, of course, mothers now can and do work outside the home and all kinds of jobs. We don't think of ourselves, at least most of us, as needing to be subservient to men. However, when you start thinking about the ways in which we are, in fact, supposed to be subservient to our children and really have very little space for ourselves or sense of self, you start to see how slowly but surely we're kind of getting back to the, you know, late 1950s.
Now you say that the new momism is deeply contradictory and that it draws from and repudiates feminism. What do you mean when you say that?
Well, you know, it wouldn't be surprising that the women, and here I'm talking about women of my generation, maybe a little older, a little younger, but women who came of age in the 70s and were breaking into careers dominated by men, careers in which women had been excluded, it would hardly be surprising that that group of women had to be overachievers to get where they were trying to get to. And it wouldn't be at all surprising that women would bring that same kind of overachievement, you know, ethos to mothering. And I think, of course, some of us have. So the very traits, you know, reading a lot, studying, learning things, working extra hard, that helped us break into a whole series of careers, we've brought to motherhood. So that does come from feminism. But at the same time, because the news media scare us, because marketers are trying to sell us stuff, because at least in the United States there's been so much of a backlash against working mothers and single mothers, there's also an element of this that represents a real attack against the gains of feminism and represents anti-feminism. So it does draw from both traditions, and we find ourselves kind of whipped around by both of them as well as mothers.
Now, your co-author, Meredith Michaels, had three children in the 1970s, and then she adopted two more 20 years later. What difference did she find in her experience as a mother in those two quite different decades?
Oh, I think the differences she found were extraordinary. And in fact, one of the things that has been really interesting about the book and going on tour, going to book signings, is that there are women in their 50s and 60s and 70s buying the book for their daughters and daughters-in-law, because these women who were raising children the same time Meredith was find that the standards today are just intolerable compared to what they found. And so Meredith's experiences have been shared by these women. So, I mean, briefly, you know, Meredith was raising her first child, well, her first two children, in the early to mid-1970s, and this was the, you know, free to be you and me moment in the United States when, you know, we were all going to raise non-sexist, non-racist children, and men and women were going to share in this equally, and women were going to be able to have children, but also, you know, have a sense of their own destiny. There was not nearly the level of marketing surrounding, you know, products for children, and there wasn't the level of fear around endangered children in the news that there is today. So, I mean, Meredith certainly feels, and she's now a grandmother, and so the expectations that she sees surrounding her daughter are just gargantuan compared to what she experienced when she herself was a young mother.
Now, we've been talking exclusively at this point about mothers, and you have called it the mommy myth. You haven't called it the daddy myth or the poppy myth. So why did you, what are the pressures on men quite different?
Well, no one would doubt that there has been a revolution in fatherhood. And that was something that really came out of the women's movement as well. Women began insisting that fathers participate more in child care and child rearing. And one of the things that millions of men discovered was that they liked being more connected to their kids. They liked being more involved. And so you have fathers today doing things that their own fathers never did. And I think that's been a welcome change, not only for children and for women, but for the men themselves. But having said that, you know, if a father knows the name of his kid's pediatrician, or you know, reads to the child at night, he's a hero. If a mother doesn't know those things, she's, you know, she's neglectful and abusive. So there certainly is, you know, a double standard, and fathers will say this themselves. You know, I have a story about a guy who had his infant in a snuggly, and, you know, was in a coffee shop buying a cup of coffee, and, you know, somebody just walked up to him out of the blue and said, "What a wonderful father," because he had this baby on him while he was getting a cup of coffee. No one would ever say that to a mother. So, you know, these expectations about perfection absolutely fall on mothers and don't on fathers in that same way at all.
Now, you say that working mothers in particular, which is a lot of mothers these days, a pull between two powerful and contradictory cultural riptides. What are those two riptides?
Well, on the one hand, and I'm sure this is as true in Canada as it is in the U.S., there's been so much speed up at work. Businesses, all kinds of workplaces are trying to do more with fewer people, and so many of us are working harder. There has been a very real, in the United States, reduction in leisure time across the board since the 1980s. Our vacations have shrunk, our work weeks have increased. So we have, you know, a reduction of leisure time, increase of work on the one hand, and on the other hand, the standards for being a good mother have also gone through the roof. So working mothers in particular are very much pulled between those two quite conflicting trends.
Does staying at home, if it's an option for a woman, get mothers any relief from the pressure of the new momism?
No. No. Because, you know, if you stay at home, then you're really expected, you know, to be, you know, doing arts and crafts with your children all day and baking cakes into the shape of Hogwarts and all the rest. So if you're a stay-at-home mom, you know, the standards are even, you know, more through the roof. So, and you find that for many, you know, in the United States, most mothers work, and they work because they have to. Staying at home is not an option for them. But many mothers work also because they like their work. But there is a group of women who choose to stay home. Some have the economic luxury of being able to do that, and it's a choice they want to make. Others do it, and it entails economic hardship for them to stay home, but they don't have decent daycare where they are or affordable daycare where they are, or they've just decided to make this decision. And for many of those women, it can be very isolating to be at home alone with small children, as much as they want to do it, as much as they love staying home. Although, on the other hand, some of them really welcome being freed from some of the stresses of work.
Now you say in your book that there is a media-created myth of the mommy wars. Now, I wasn't familiar with that, but what is that you're referring to?
We've had that here for a while now, and it's just really, it's just infuriating. Every once in a while, a magazine will have on its cover something about the mommy wars. And there are also we've had TV shows here about the mommy wars. And here it is, supposedly stay-at-home mothers and working mothers hate each other's guts. The stay-at-home mothers supposedly think that the working mothers are selfish and neglectful, and the working mothers supposedly think that the stay-at-home mothers are boring and not being good role models for their children, especially their daughters, right? That's how it gets set up. Now, in real life, stay-at-home mothers and working mothers help each other out all the time. Their kids play together. They schlep their kids back and forth, together from one place to another. But the media have inflamed this because it sells magazines. It sells TV shows. Now, are there sometimes tensions between working mothers and stay-at-home mothers? Sure there are. But, I mean, what I found, again, in my book tour and the reaction we've gotten to the book, is that mothers themselves agree that this is a completely hyped-up war, but that when you read about it in magazines or see it on, allegedly staged on television, you think, well, it's real. It really must be out there. Other mothers must be feeling it, and I guess I have to take sides. So I think this is a very big media exaggeration. Mothers, whether they work outside the home or, work inside the home, we care about the same thing for our kids.
Now, you have a hilarious chapter called The Attack of the Celebrity Moms. Who are they?
Oh, the celebrity moms. These are the perfect, beautiful, rich actresses and or supermodels or, occasionally a rock or music star who are we see on the covers of women's magazines, perfectly made up, with their perfect clothes and hairdos. Their kids are perfectly made up. And, it's always about something and their miracle baby. And you go inside, and their houses are decorated in white. They have white shag rugs and white sofas, this with the toddlers and infants. And inside, the stories tell you all of the things that they are doing to ensure that their kids will be Nobel laureates by the time they're 12, even though the moms are, working on the set 12 hours a day. And there has been a real explosion of these magazines. Back in the 70s, there were hardly any celebrity moms on the covers of women's magazines. And by the late 80s and early 90s, in the U.S., between one-fifth and one-quarter of the covers featured these celebrity moms. And I think, they just present the most preposterous image of perfect, stress-free, indulged motherhood. But I think what I find especially pernicious about them and why I really wanted to make fun of them is that they tell you how you're supposed to feel. And how you're supposed to feel is blissed out all the time. And, I'm sorry, we all adore our children, but having a child and raising a child is exhausting and at times exasperating. And you're not blissed out all the time, and there's no reason you should feel that way. It's hard work.
Now, the flip side, of course, of the celebrity moms is the welfare mother. How do the American media represent women on welfare?
Well, what was really important to us was to put these two kinds of motherhood images in conversation with each other because they circulated through the American media in the late 80s and early 90s at exactly the same time, but you would never think about them together. But I think they were very important parts of a kind of diptych here because on the one side were the perfect, rich, white, beautiful, enviable celebrity moms we were all supposed to emulate, however impossible that was. And on the other side were, in the U.S., the poor African-American unmarried celebrity, welfare mothers, who were consistently portrayed as lazy, as neglectful, as not caring about their children. And at the end, it was it perpetuated a quite dreadful stereotype that African-American mothers are ipso facto bad mothers. And so we really did want to go through and look at the ways in which celebrity mothers had been portrayed and how they had been vilified in the media.
Welfare mothers,
I'm sorry, yes.
Now, what is the political context behind these media representations of women, both the welfare mothers and the celebrity moms whose babies are more important than those wonderful jobs they have?
Well, I think for welfare mothers, there began to be, under the Reagan presidency here, a real attack on a variety of social programs, and welfare was very much high on Reagan's list. And so there began to be, on talk shows here, many attacks on welfare mothers as kind of the source of everything wrong with the United States. And it was really a constant drumbeat, and these conservative politicians helped set the agenda for the news media and news coverage of welfare. And this, of course, persisted when Bill Clinton was running for president in 92 and insisted that he was going to end welfare as we know it, and that again set the agenda. So really between the late 80s and early 90s, until welfare quote-unquote reform was passed in this country, there were just so many stories about the kind of parasitic nature of welfare mothers that really distorted their lives and what they do. What the media focused on here families in which there was a 14-year-old pregnant girl on welfare, her mother who was on welfare, and the grandmother who was on welfare, you know, kind of like the Ming dynasty of, you know, people on welfare. And in reality, those people were a tiny, tiny fraction of folks on welfare. But that was what was sensational, but it also helped set policy.
And I guess the other issue is the issue of child care. There were huge cuts to child care in that era.
Well, such that we had any child care. I mean, we are the only, industrialized nation that does not have a decent national child care or nursery or preschool program. And so we've never, ever had that. We've always had a patchwork system here. But even what existed has been cut, and this is particularly true for lower-income women. But daycare has also been demonized in this country for so long. I mean, it's just to read, and there is a chapter in the book about daycare and why we don't have it. And when you read the kind of hysteria that has persisted in the United States about daycare and daycare being bad, you just can't believe, you know, that anybody in this country has any brains. The commentary has just been absolutely idiotic, but we still do not have daycare in this country.
How can mothers fight back against this pernicious trend, the new momism?
Well, you know, I think one of the first things to do, and this may sound trivial, but I don't think it is to really talk back to this imagery. I think one of the most important inventions of the women's movement was the consciousness-raising group. And this was just a brilliant stroke in the 1970s. You know, women got together in small groups all over the country and began starting to talk about the myths that held them down then. And that then led to very significant political and social action on the part of women, because once the scales fell off, then you could see what you might do politically. I think it's time for that again. I think the first step is we really have to talk back to these notions that we should be perfect, that we have to devote every ounce of our physical, psychological, and emotional selves to our children 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We have to shorten the to-do list and just rely a lot more on common sense, and also talk back to these images, because one of the things that they do is that they divide us against each other instead of helping us see how we have very powerful common needs that focus around our children, and that our government here in the United States and certainly our workplaces, just are not attending to.
I have to say, I think another good way to start would be to read your book. I found it very, very informative and entertaining.
Well, thanks so much.
Thanks very much for talking to us this morning, Susan.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Susan Douglas. Susan Douglas and Meredith Michaels are the authors of The Mommy Myth. It's published by Free Press, and it will be out in paperback in February.
You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada.